Governor Pritzker has signed 8 executive orders since his term began on everything from labor to immigration to climate change.
This commits Illinois to promoting clean energy deployment and pursuing climate action now. While the president is intent on taking us backward, I will work hard every day to move this state forward.
Thanks to the State Journal Register for that audio. We'll break down what's new and what these orders say about the Pritzker administration. Plus, this coming tax season will be the first under the new federal tax law. How can Illinois taxpayers prepare?
Because our tax laws so frequently change as the political climate changes, maintaining records in order to get the best overall tax deduction is smart.
We have some tips on how to get everything ready to file by April. Finally, nowadays, parents aren't the only ones puzzling over their homework at the kitchen table. Sometimes parents and guardians need an extra hand understanding it, too. We'll learn about a new pilot program out of Champaign that aims to help. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. I hope everyone enjoyed your weekend with the warm weather. Hopefully you had a chance to get outside and enjoy it. Coming up this hour, Governor J.B. Pritzker has started his third week in office, and he's already signed 8 executive orders. We're going to learn more about that, as well as a new pilot program in Champaign that's designed to give parents tools they need to better help their kids with homework. But first, your taxes aren't due until April 15th, but it's never too early to get started, especially this year because there's been a lot of changes. For one thing, it's the first tax season when the federal tax cut, which passed late in 2017, will actually take effect. And of course, for 35 days, starting in December and going well into January, IRS employees worked without pay during the government shutdown. We've got a couple of Illinois tax experts on the line to give us their tips for this time of year. As always, you're welcome to join us with any questions you have. You can tweet us. Our handle's 21STShow, or you can give us a call. That number is 1-800-222-9455. Our experts with us are Carmi Gregory. She's got more than 45 years of tax experience. She's a tax advisor with H&R Block in Sycamore in DeKalb County. Drake Zimmerman is a principal for First Allied Securities in Normal. Carmi, Drake, good morning. Welcome to the 21st.
Good morning.
Carmi, let's start with you. When we're thinking about filing this time around, how big of a change are this year's taxes compared to previous years?
I think one of the biggest changes is the look. People that are used to using their prior year as sort of a template for their current year, it doesn't look the same at all. So I think that's one of the biggest changes for a lot of the do-it-yourselfers. In terms of the actual taxes themselves, with the reduction in the tax rates, with the loss of the dependent, everybody's looking to say, hey, where do I put my kid? Well, you don't put your kid. They still account for it, and the kids still count for the child tax credits. They still count for babysitting. They still count for, perhaps if they're over 17, for the family credit. They still count for the education credits, but they don't physically show up on that front page like you're used to seeing them.
Mm.
Also, the thing that we're finding is a lot of people who in the past have gotten $4,000 or $5,000 or $6,000 as a refund may not be getting that much this year because they were getting it in their paychecks as each paycheck came out during the year. So those are some of the biggest changes that hit people automatically.
Yeah, those are some big ones right up front. Drake, I wonder how time-consuming it was to get yourself and everyone else in your office up to speed on how different tax law is this year.
Oh, it was very time-consuming. Back at the end of 17, we went through everybody's return to see what kind of planning we had to do in 17 preparing for 18. And then for 18, with all the changes, there seemed to be a change again and again and again that we would discover. So we spent a lot of time going through everybody's itemized deductions, everybody's income, and the type of income. Was it capital gains? Was it ordinary income? What were they giving was really important, and how much they give, because until you give a particular level, you don't get any deductions. But once you hit that level, you get all of your deductions are very good. We do a lot of charitable planning. I'm a chartered advisor in philanthropy, like a CPA, only a CAP. And so we do a lot of charitable planning.
I want to get to some of those details about charitable planning second with you, Drake. But Carmi, mm-hmm. Can I ask you about the government shutdown? And if you saw ripple effects in your work, whether that was with communicating with the IRS or with clients who may have been affected?
There was a great deal of it, because anybody that had items pending with the IRS, even if it was in collections. Collections was working at about 50% where they normally would work, and it meant longer times hanging on the phone if that was what you were trying to connect with.
And so, collections meaning people who owe the IRS money or the reverse?
People who owe the IRS and they were trying to work out a payment plan with
them. I see.
It could still be done, but it was taking much longer to get all of that done. People that had IRS letters or they were in audit, everything was just sort of suspended for that 35, 38 days. Talking with an agent last Thursday, and I said to her, I said, do you anticipate the next shutdown? She said, we are planning for it. We're not going to get caught like we were last time. So even many of them in the service center are indicating that they're planning for another shutdown, but they're doing business as usual, and they're trying to get caught up on the myriad amounts of correspondences that had come in while they were shut down.
Drake, what advice do you have for us, the taxpayer, on our end in terms of how we should be prepared in case there is another government shutdown next week?
Patience and planning. The IRS people have been cut in staff even before this. They then get hit with a new tax law, and then on top of that, they get shut down. So please be very warm and respectful, and these people are trying to do a very difficult job to begin with and then had the shutdown on top of that. So please be kind to all, be kind to your IRS agent.
That's a good reminder, Drake. Carmi, can I ask also, this is a good time to remind everyone, this time of year, there's also a danger of fraud and scams. I think it kind of goes up a little bit. It's a good reminder, Drake said he was talking about correspondence. The IRS never calls or emails anyone, right, Carmi?
That's quite correct. Unless you have already an ongoing issue where you have given permission to them to talk to you, they will not call you. They send everything by correspondence. If it gets to a certain stage, it then becomes certified letters. They will not just arbitrarily make that phone call, nor will they just arbitrarily come out and knock on your door unless there's been a whole history of items along the way, a whole history of correspondences being ignored, not responded to properly, not timely responded and answered on. And that includes Social Security and the state of Illinois likewise. Now many of the scammers are beginning to call, and they're no longer identifying themselves as Internal Revenue Service. They're beginning to identify themselves as being with Social Security or with the state of Illinois or whatever state might be involved, trying to work around this whole system of, well, people are now getting smart and they're not going to respond if we say Internal Revenue Service.
So just a reminder. Go ahead, Drake.
Correct. The Federal Trade Commission has stamped on those scams again and again, but it's like you stamp on one and five more splash out. And it is the other agencies that are getting, are having their names dragged into the mud, the Social Security and the others.
And to that point, Drake, also about Social Security, if you're social, it's always better to file earlier rather than later. And that's also in case of fraud or if your Social Security number has been stolen, right?
Absolutely.
Generally, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Carmi, so let's go to some of these changes in the tax law. You mentioned some of them in the beginning. I wonder if we can get to some specifics here. You talked about, first of all, and I think this is an important one for people who are used to claiming dependents. What does that look like on the form now? What information do people need to know about that?
Well, people would still, depending upon the program they're using, and of course if it's with a commercial preparer such as H&R Block, they would also have our programs automatically. We put the children's names in, birth dates and all of this, so that it carries through our program. If they're doing it themselves, then they need to be very careful that if they're doing like a babysitting form, that the right child's name, identification, birth date, and all is properly placed in there. If they're doing an education form, that they make sure they get the correct child's information put into there so that it follows on through with what they have going on in their return. If they're claiming someone who is over the age of 17, that they have identified that person so they get the family credit. That's $500 per person that's coming along if they qualify for it. Making sure that they have properly identified by name and the full name, Social Security number, and birth date, so when it follows through to Internal Revenue Service, that it can easily be identified. A lot of mismatches between names and Social Security numbers are still happening. A few minutes ago, Drake mentioned the itemized deductions when he was talking. That's another issue that we've had clients that for years have been able to write off employee business expenses, their mileages, if they were a truck driver, a W-2 truck driver. They're over the road per diems for meals. If they were a teacher, their classroom supplies. If they were an auto mechanic and they were building their box of tools, those costs of those tools. All of that has gone, union dues.
So that's all changed now?
How is it? No longer a deductible by an employee.
Okay. None of those are qualify anymore, Carmi.
Correct.
And Drake, the standard deduction has also gone up, right? Can you explain a little bit more about that?
Every individual starts now with a higher standard deduction, which is $12,000. If you are above the age of 65, at or above 65, it's slightly higher. So a $12,000 single individual deduction would be $13,600. If you're married filing jointly, the $24,000 and both are 65 or older goes to $26,600. What that means and what that translates into is that you have to have more itemizable deductions, the medical, the charitable, the mortgage interest, the state and local taxes that have to get to and beyond those levels.
That threshold.
Before they are deductible.
So theoretically, it sounds like the changes, like Carmi, everything you were talking about, whether it would be meals or things that people would claim as expenses, theoretically, some of that should get folded into this deduction threshold rate rising, correct?
Correct. That's one of the things they were hoping to reduce the need for itemized deductions by doubling the standard deduction. And it has helped a bit. But it's also cut out an awful lot of individuals. For example, many of them would have gone over that 12 or 18 or 24 amount if they could itemize. And the other thing was the reduction on the state and local taxes. Even now, people who have been able to itemize because they had fairly high real estate taxes or fairly high withholdings or the combination of the two, that has a restriction of no more than $10,000 for all of their taxes. That's hurt a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
With Drake being involved in the charitable group, that is still in effect. There was a lot of people who during the year thought they couldn't itemize anymore because they couldn't take off their charitable. But someone who is extremely philanthropic will still be able to write those charities off. If they've got $40,000 in charitable donations, they can still write them off. They'll still go over their 12 or 18 or 24 amount.
Right. So what's the threshold then, Drake, when we're thinking about charitable as well? Is it the same threshold?
You group it together with the other itemizable deductions, so medical plus mortgage plus charitable and your state and local taxes. When you put those all together, for an individual single, do you pass $12,000? Well, if you're making, say, $100,000 in wages, you pay about $5,000 in state taxes. If you have a house that has property taxes of $5,000, you now have 5 plus 5. You've hit the limit on your state and local taxes. So if you're a single person, you only have to get $2,000 more of charitable deductions before you can deduct it.
I see.
So what you do with what you have the most control over the charitable deductions. And so what we've been doing is having people look at their charitable deductions, group them. So if you give to your faith organization, you might do two.
Or your local public radio station.
Or your local public radio. For full disclosure, I'm the longest running corporate donor for local WGLT.
Oh, well, thank you. On behalf of WGLT, sure.
Sure, for the last 35 years.
Can I ask you, Drake, I wonder how much things have changed in 35 years in terms of record keeping. And I was laughing during the Super Bowl commercial last night for Expensify. I don't know if you guys saw that, but it was basically the rap. It was 2 Chainz talking about how he has an app to take charge of his expenses. And I wanted to ask you guys, we have a couple more minutes here just as we wrap up, just to ask about best practices going forward for people in terms of keeping track of their finances, keeping track of records. Do you have an opinion, Drake, first of all, on paper or electronic, which one's best?
Whatever works for you. We have a lot of people who will have a series of envelopes or paper bags even, or boxes that we have them throw their bills into over the course of the year, or a drawer. Others will keep it electronically. It sort of depends on which part of the millennium, which millennium you were born in. And the idea is keep records. If you have good records, there's no fear for an audit unless you're doing something nefarious, or the fear of an audit. You get an audit letter and you say, oh, I have all those receipts. Let me just copy them and send them. Whether you have them electronically or in paper, you've got it there. People get this letter from the IRS. Usually audits are paper audits. They send you a letter and they say, you owe this. Then you say, oh, well, actually, you're asking about this or this, my charitable deductions. I've got receipts for all those and copies of things. I'll just send those all in, and you're fine. So keep good paperwork. However you keep them is the key advice.
Carmi, what advice do you have for people who are not good at keeping good paperwork?
Start. What I do find, and I will have to rubber stamp what Drake just said, although I do lean more towards the paper rather than the electronic, the reason being is that after 18 to 24 months, some of those electronics just automatically disappear, and then they don't have that documentation. For example, if they have tollway expenses, you can pull down your tollway expenses for up to, I believe it's 18 months, and then after that you can't go back further. Many of these audits would take place longer than 18 months later. If somebody is keeping their records and you can't use it this year, don't throw it out, though. Keep it because there's a chance there's going to be a retroactive ruling, such as we had last year on February 8th. There was a five major items were retroactively reinstated for the year 17. That meant amended returns if you'd already filed to be able to use those. And we always are looking at that possibility. Keep them at least 1 year before you toss them out, just in case there's going to be a retroactive.
3 to 5 years would be better because sometimes they do, things will carry
forward. Rubber stamp that also.
Okay, so 3 to 5 years, keep records, get better at keeping records. This is a good time to start if you have not done that this year.
It's only a month behind, so yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I would add, please plan in advance. Most of what you can do for your 2018 taxes had a deadline of 34 days ago.
Okay, well, that's another good thing to plan for. I want to thank Drake Zimmerman with First Allied Securities in Normal, Carmi Gregory with the H&R Block office in Sycamore. Carmi, Drake, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Yeah,
thank you. It's good talking with you.
Support comes from Krannert Art Museum at the University of Illinois, presenting Kennedy Brown, The Special Relationship, on view now through February 9th, with a gallery conversation about art, privacy, and the Internet this Friday at 3 p.m. More information at kam.illinois.edu.
Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. If you're a parent or grandparent listening out there, you know how hard it can be to help children with their homework. But there's a new program in Champaign called the Parent Lab that will help tutor parents so they have the tools to help their kids. Tonight at Booker T. Washington School Library in Champaign, families are able to grab a meal and sign up, and they'll have orientation for those who are interested in the Parent Lab, which is a new pilot project. Joining me in our Urbana studios to tell us more about the program is Katina Wilcher, the Director of Student, Family, and Community Engagement for Unit 4 Schools. Also with us is Amanda Harris. She's the Manager of Project Read at Parkland College. Both of these groups working to create this Parent Lab pilot program. Katina, Amanda, thanks for being here. Welcome to the 21st.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Katina, I just wanted to start, first of all, with what you're hearing from the parents in your school district in terms of what are some of the struggles that parents have when it comes to helping their children with homework?
Well, one of the biggest struggles is the fact that the way we do math and reading, right, in the 21st century looks very different than the way many of our parents learned. And oftentimes, kids will go home with a different strategy that parents are not familiar with because we learned to do math and reading differently. And so one of the struggles is, one, exposure to the curriculum and really knowing what is in front of kids day in and day out, and then the know-how in terms of navigating how to do the work. And so our parents overwhelmingly stated that homework help is something that is attractive to them, something that they really hope to have access to in terms of really supporting kids when they come home.
And I think it's a really tough position for parents to be in, right? To say, nobody wants to tell their kid, I don't know how to do this, right? So that's also, I think, starting immediately, it's a difficult position.
Absolutely. And so that's one of the things that we try to normalize, the fact that it can be challenging. But even from a personal perspective, even as an educator, I struggle with helping my son do his homework. And so really trying to normalize many of the challenges that our families face and just meeting people where they're at, right, I think is key. And so we're trying to do this in a non-intrusive, non-invasive way to really make it okay to say, I need support with this.
And that's Katina Wilcher with Unit 4 Schools in Champaign. Amanda Harris is also with us with Parkland College, where she's the manager of Project READ. Amanda, can you first tell us a little bit about Project READ and how both of you working together ended up creating this pilot program?
Sure, I'd be happy to. So Project READ is an adult volunteer literacy program that's funded by the Illinois State Library. That's a division of the Secretary of State's office. And it's an adult volunteer literacy program, which means that all of our services are delivered by trained volunteers. So Project READ at my office, we train and support volunteers in how to best work with adults on their educational and career goals. The general scope of our service is throughout District 505, which is a community college district that has Champaign County at the heart, but it actually has pieces of 12 counties throughout central Illinois. And we serve adults who are age 17 and over who have a ninth grade or below equivalency in either math, reading or writing, or our English language learners with an intermediate level or less. And so the learners who come to Project READ are coming to us because they want to get a job promotion, and they've been offered a promotion, but we're told that they need to pass a basic skills test. They may have a high school diploma, but realize that they no longer know how to do math as agilely as they need to. They may be English language learners, the bulk of our learners are actually English language learners.
And did you find that you also had parents in that equation too?
I have a lot of parents. So right now we serve about 260 adults, all in Champaign-Urbana and Rantoul, basically, is where our programs are. And many of the adults, I think almost everyone, is a parent. And oftentimes they come and they say that one of their stated goals is to be able to go to a parent-teacher conference or to be able to help their child with their homework or to be able to engage with teachers. And so we have an awareness that literacy of a child is very closely correlated with the literacy of the parent, particularly the mother.
And I was going to ask you guys about that. How important does it matter? How important is it for children to have support within their family for their homework? Because I wonder, does it matter if they get support somewhere else, or does it make a big difference when it's within their family and it's directly from parents or grandparents? Katina?
So I think it's crucial for kids to see their families and whoever their family members are really embrace what it is that they're learning as well. And sometimes help can come from tutors or other various sources. But seeing the active engagement at home is priceless. Mm-hmm. It's meaningful. And one of the things that we do acknowledge when it comes to parent engagement and being involved is that it can look different for different people, right? And so we acknowledge and embrace what's meaningful to different families, but we want to also meet people where they're at in terms of offering these resources, because there is a lot of value in kids seeing their families endorse what they're up to.
And Amanda, it sounds like the research also backs that up as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I understand from a study at the around 2000 that about 60% of four-year-olds whose parents have a college degree or more get read to every day. And only 20% of children whose parents get read to every day if their parents have not gone to college. And so if you don't have the post-secondary education or if there isn't a continuing or lifelong learning environment in the household, it's much less likely that the children will be read to. And as you can imagine, the amount of words that a child is exposed to at a given age correlates to how often they're read to.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I wonder for you all, too, how much do you think this is an issue of time? And parents having the time, no matter, I'm thinking about, particularly if you're thinking about maybe people, parents who are engaged in hourly work, mm-hmm. probably having more than one job.
Absolutely. And I'm just going to, I have to jump on this because
Absolutely.
This is one of the things that when we work with our tutors to train them to work with adults, this is one of the big emphases that we have is that many adults seek out educational services or want to, mm-hmm. but then wind up not being able to make the commitment to a regular class, which is why we love having this flexibility of tutoring services. But we have adults that have multiple jobs. We have adults who are single parents. We have adults who are caring for their other older family members. And so the ability to commit to their own education is diminished because of that, the time constraints. And so you have people who are very, very capable and that are contributing to our economy, that are contributing to our community, but they just frankly don't have time to fit it into their schedule, which is why we're so excited about this collaboration with Unit 4.
So how have you all structured this to fit that population?
One of the things I think we were very intentional about was saying, let's remove some of the barriers, right?
Yes.
Families.
Like what?
For example, one of the things we're going to offer is a family meal for families to come out.
Oh, so that's great. So that solves one problem, which is what to make for dinner and the time that that involves.
Absolutely. And also the intentionality behind where we're choosing to place mm-hmm. the parent lab, right? It will be housed at Booker T. Washington STEM Academy, which is one of our neighborhood schools, is one of our community schools, which is within close proximity to the Douglas Branch Library. So even access, being able to access the lab, again, not worrying about what you're going to fix for dinner, being able to come to the space and have some of those needs met already.
And I understand, will there also be childcare offered as well?
There will be, and it's also...
So for other children, for all the children?
Absolutely. So one of the things that we've been, again, very intentional about when we have our parent engagement events and activities is ensuring that we provide meaningful childcare activities for all ages. And so that's what we're going to be up to, ensuring that if they have a toddler that comes, that we have age-appropriate activities for them to do as well.
And so you all are signing people up for this now. What are you hoping? How many people are you hoping to get involved with this? And what will actually happen when the parents come to the lab?
So this is kind of a twofold question. We're hoping for about 10 families. And that may mean 20 kids, 30 kids. It may mean 10 kids. We'd like them to be engaged in, the children to be engaged in the activities. The child-parent together time will be during meals. And then there will also be library activities once a month on the second Mondays, where we'll have a library tour with resources like digital learning, parent-family reading, knowing how to identify books that are appropriate for your child's reading level. So parents will have that opportunity to have together time with their kids and then also have childcare while they're engaging in their tutoring services. So on the one hand, we may have parents who want to work on English language skills or maybe somebody that wants to work on math. But on the other hand, we may have parents who really just want to focus on how is math taught now, in which case Katina and folks from Unit 4 will be there to be able to explain more specifically the most effective ways of engaging with the schools.
Katina, you're nodding. Are you also hoping that this will attract, I imagine, parents of all socioeconomic levels? Are you hoping that you'll see a diverse group of people who are attending?
Absolutely. We're hoping for a diverse group of people who come out, but more importantly, those who need it most. And that's whatever they look like and wherever they come from. We want it to be impactful for the families who need it most. And I wanted to just speak a little bit to the data. When we had our needs and asset findings in 2016-17, more than 60% of the parents who completed the survey supported homework help. And so this is definitely a need that parents and families have identified. And so we're really excited about being able to answer the call.
I wonder if you can share any tips with us that you're going to be sharing with parents, or any advice that you can give to parents who are listening all throughout the state who might not be able to attend this particular pilot program.
Oh, I don't know where to start.
Right.
You know, one of the kind of rules that I've always, one of the things that I've always believed in is that communities are stronger and individuals are stronger when they participate in healthy, productive activities together, and that the relationships that are forged among children and among families are more enduring and more uplifting when you have a focus on something that is an enrichment, like an academic enrichment for or arts enrichment or something like that. And so I would stress that for people who are new to the community, for people who may not have tried it, that because you think maybe it would be socially awkward or something like that, that the empowerment that comes from these kinds of activities and the relationships that come from these kinds of activities are uplifting and long-lasting.
Well said.
Katina, I wonder what hopes you have out of, what are you hoping to see come out of the Parent Lab?
I would like to echo a lot of what Amanda said, but additionally, I'd like to see parents and guardians come out and really have those needs met in terms of literacy and math, being able to really support the academic success of their students while reducing the frustration that we often encounter with trying to help students at home with homework, their kids.
And you said something at the beginning, and I just want to come back to that, just the whole idea of normalizing frustration that adults may have with children's homework.
Sure.
And I wonder, both of you are nodding. It sounds like both of you also have personal experience with this.
Absolutely.
And I feel like it's always frustrating when I've been trying to teach math and I'm like, well, that's not how I do it. And then the response is, but that's not how the teacher told me how to do it.
Absolutely.
So
right.
I wonder what advice you have for trying to cope with that. I mean, is it, I think it sounds like it's, you really want to be, at least with the Unit 4 schools, you all want to be opening up a channel between the school
sure.
and parents to hope that they can understand a little bit more about what's going into this, right?
Absolutely. And I think the biggest key to that is approach, right? Again, going back to the notion of meeting people where they're at, really establishing and cultivating an environment of trust, and going back to the relationship piece is going to be huge. And really partnering, because one of the things that we know is that we have parents who are going to be receivers of knowledge, but we also have parents who are producers of knowledge.
Thank you. Yes,
and really
yes.
acknowledging their strengths and really capitalizing on those strengths and really just going to the next level. But doing it in a way that says, you know what, we're in this together and we're here to support your growth, our collective growth, because when our kids excel and they do well, we all win. And so that's our hope, is to see that happen.
And so this pilot program will begin this evening. There's sign up. That's correct. It's at
right.
So there's, we'll have the information at our website, but that's at 5:30. There's a pilot program that's starting called Parent Lab. This is a collaboration between Parkland College, Project Read, and Unit 4 schools in Champaign. Amanda, before we go, can I just ask you one last question? I wonder, it sounds like you guys have put a lot of training into the tutors that are going to be working with this program. How is it teaching? I'd imagine teaching adults is a little bit different than teaching children.
Teaching adults is a lot different than teaching children, and there's a growing body of research on what are the best practices for working with adults. But adults tend, I'm going to focus on one of the I think what's the most salient aspect, is that adults need to feel that what they're learning is relevant. It's a good use of their time. Adults are goal-oriented and self-motivated, and they will learn better if they feel that it is a good use of their time and energy.
Mm.
And so that's one of the things that we really focus on with our tutors, and we also make sure that everybody understands that they are going to learn just as much from the adult learner that they're working with as the adult learner is going to learn from them. They just have different areas of expertise.
That's Amanda Harris. She's the manager of Project Read at Parkland College. I want to thank Katina Wilcher for being with us as well with Unit 4 Schools. We'll have more information at our website about this parent lab and this pilot program. If you're interested, head to 21stshow.org. Katina, Amanda, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for tuning in to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The legislative session in Springfield is in full swing. Governor J.B. Pritzker is just beginning his fourth week in office, a correction for what we said earlier. With majorities in both chambers, Democrats have been trying to pass laws that fit their priorities, including laws that didn't make it past Governor Rauner's desk last year or laws they didn't introduce because a Republican was in the governor's seat. We spent a lot of time breaking down the state laws that affect us throughout the state, but there's another way that governors can move the needle on their agendas, and that's executive orders. So far, Governor Pritzker has signed 8. How does all of this work? What do they say about where the Pritzker administration is headed? Joining me now to talk about this is Amanda Vinicky, a correspondent with WTTW Chicago Tonight. Joe Bustos is also with us, a reporter with the Belleville News Democrat. Amanda, Joe, welcome back to the 21st. Good morning.
My pleasure.
Good morning. Thanks for it.
Amanda, can you just start by reminding us, is an executive order the governor signs, is that just like a presidential executive order? Is it kind of the same principle?
Yeah, I mean, you could think of it as that. I would say an executive order, one of the, I guess you could pose it as a danger, is that it can be rescinded by the next governor, so it does not have the full force of law in that regard. And something that's, I think, most important, and I'm guessing I'm going to bring up again throughout the course of our conversation, is that this is, of course, something that has not been negotiated, that it is just that, an executive order, something that the chief executive can do on his or her own. And therefore has not been both digested through the legislature, or you hear a lot of talk from J.B. Pritzker about bipartisanship. That isn't behind a lot of these executive orders. So these are things that he is doing on his own, and therefore we should look at as a lens of where he plans to take the administration.
Right. And so let's look at these things that Democrat J.B. Pritzker, Governor Pritzker, is doing, Amanda, to underscore that point. And Joe, let's start with immigration. I wonder if you can share a little bit about this executive order that he signed recently and what he's directing different state, looking at state government to do.
So it was an immigration order, or excuse me, an executive order that talks about expanding access to welcome centers, and it allows to give information to immigrants and people who are refugees or seeking asylum about state programs that are available to them to promote their civil rights in the state and maybe get some economic opportunity. This is in the lens of President Trump, who wants to build a wall. Some interpreting that as being anti-immigrant. So this is kind of the backlash against President Trump's priorities.
And we've certainly heard Governor Pritzker be very vocal in his critiques of President Trump. We're going to get into some of those now. In fact, I wanted to just actually play some other audio. Amanda, I want to ask you about a couple of actions Governor Pritzker took on his very first day in office, and they had to do with labor. He first restored pay increases for nearly 20,000 state workers and then signed 2 executive orders related to pay equity in agencies. And I want to just play a little bit of what he said.
Look, I believe in collective bargaining rights. I believe that we need to stand up for workers in the state. We're obviously going to be entering negotiations at some point in the near future to discuss wages going forward and all of the other issues. But it's very important for us to establish on day one that this is a very different kind of administration and that we're focusing on lifting up working families.
Thanks to WTTW for that audio. Amanda, as we think about that, Governor Pritzker saying from day one he wants to establish something different. I wonder if we can explain a little bit of the backstory there, what it looks like. I know there's some ongoing contract negotiations with AFSCME, how that went with Governor Rauner, and how you think it will be different now.
All right, I'm going to try to actually separate this into a couple of pieces. And first of that is just the tenor of his remarks. And of course, it comes after Governor Bruce Rauner, who organized labor, saw as the evil incarnate and their arch nemesis. Rauner, of course, maintains that he is not anti-labor, merely anti what he perceived as these union bosses and an unfair, corrupt
public workers,
is what he
too.
Termed it. For
right.
public workers,
not
and
for private
giving
workers.
Money to politicians and giving money to politicians, and then those very same politicians negotiate a contract with them. And we did see, for example, I think Rauner would say Pritzker is going to be another one. Pritzker, of course, largely paid for his own campaign and doesn't need the union money. But sure, he definitely appreciated the union bodies and the union endorsements, and now will be, in a sense, Rauner or other critics, Rauner is not alone in this, would say, hey, look, now he's negotiating a contract with them. He's more apt to give them money, your money, public dollars, as a sort of thanks, or if he wants another term 4 years down. So in general, though, of course, Pritzker would say, no, I believe that it is a rising tide lifts all boats, and that if you have higher union wages, he, of course, also is trying to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour here in Illinois. Up from $8.25. So,
and Amanda, these increases, these were step increases, right? And when we're thinking about how much pay was being raised, I think we should be clear about that.
Yeah. So again, that was not actually an executive order. His executive orders, there was one that kind of got dealt with labor, and then another that, again, a measure that was stunted under Rauner that there still, I'm anticipating, will be a measure that becomes law in Illinois now that we have all Democrats in control that will forbid employers from asking employees about their previous pay, because that is seen as something that widens the gender equity gap, and women are paid less because you start off paying at a lower wage and then you continue throughout your career. That was an executive order. The step wage was not. Rather, after a series of court orders that, frankly, Rauner just put off complying with, that is what this comes at the tail end of. And Pritzker said, hey, no more. We're going to both comply with these orders and pay, as you noted, they are step increases. So it is for people that are at the beginning of their public service careers as employees of the state. They are due to get, I mean, it can range, but let's say, you know, 60 cents more an hour, $2 more an hour, what have you, the longer that they have been in state government to bring them to a certain wage. And those are the ones that now Pritzker said will be paid, and that will be at least going forward. He did not actually yet tackle the back pay, all of the missed step increases under the Rauner administration. So it'll be new paychecks going forward that still, of course, is going to cost Illinois a pretty penny. Some, I believe it's $50 million at a time where already the budget that Pritzker inherited is going to be one that starts at a deficit. And so this adds to that deficit.
So we're not even at the whole back pay issue yet. Joe, can I ask?
Not yet.
Yeah, so that's a whole other, it sounds like there's a lot that needs to be unraveled there. And that issue continues to be ongoing when we're thinking about state worker pay. I want to ask about another worker issue, Joe, and that's Governor Pritzker made his first trip actually outside of Springfield to St. Clair County to Southwestern Illinois College in your neck of the woods to sign in another executive order. What was that about?
So it was mainly it was like a workforce training executive order and how best to align state money and federal dollars into which programs or which jobs may be growing in the future. He gave examples during this signing, like he cited IT or green technology or innovations in agriculture. And he did this at a community college, and it was a packed room with lots of Democrats in there, local Democrats. It was in an atrium where there were people who were standing on the balcony trying to see the governor on his first trip outside of Springfield, and he came to St. Clair County, which was a county that voted for him, one of 16 counties in the state to vote for him, and the local Democrats actually endorsed Pritzker before the primary, so they were very supportive of him. And one of the things that I found interesting about this is workforce training. It's kind of a bipartisan thing. So they had State Senator Paul Schimpf at the event who gave some remarks saying if we ever disagree, we'll disagree as friends. So that honeymoon period was still going on when he signed this particular executive order.
Right. So there's some bipartisanship there, right, Joe? At least for now. I wanted to play some more audio from a different executive order, and that's something else that Governor Pritzker did. You mentioned green jobs. This has to do with the U.S. Climate Alliance. That's a group of states that want to follow the emission standards laid out in the Paris Climate Accord, and Illinois is now part of the U.S. Climate Alliance. Here's what Governor Pritzker had to say, signing the executive order that put our state into the U.S. Climate Alliance.
This commits Illinois to promoting clean energy deployment and pursuing climate action now. While the president is intent on taking us backward, I will work hard every day to move this state forward.
Joe, I wonder how much you think this signals possible legislation, how much, as we think about all of these executive orders, whether we're talking about immigration or climate change or worker education or pay, do you see a thread here?
Well, I mean, this is, again, one of those anti-Trump things. I mean, this one calls for reducing carbon emissions. And Illinois already, I think, even set a goal for reducing carbon emissions. Illinois has a goal of reducing carbon emissions by 25%, making it to a point where we're actually relying on 25% renewable energy by 2025. And this was part of a plan that was set in 2018 by the Illinois Commerce Commission under the Future Energy Jobs Act. So it includes large utilities and local small co-ops. So, I mean, this is part of a progressive plan that Governor Pritzker had talked about during the campaign, and he's continuing to push.
Amanda, I wonder, this is probably just a straight yes answer, how much of Governor Pritzker's agenda will be to point out what Joe said, just kind of countering President Trump?
Yeah, I think there's that right now. It is pushing back against Trump. But really, you know, Nyla, to your question in terms of a common thread, I think a common thread that we can see throughout all of these executive orders is, number one, that they're easy pickings. He is still in a honeymoon period. These are all measures that appeal to his base, but can be done via executive order, don't need to be hashed out through the legislature. So he is doing a continuous stream of, you know, press pops and such. He's getting his name out there. I will add, we are still waiting, however, for what I would consider more of the meat and the material. Of course, the U.S. Climate Accord, I'm not saying that some of this is not meat, but some of these other executive orders seem to be kind of smaller in nature, or making, some have criticized them as making a big deal out of really nothing, or making a big deal about an issue that is small, when Illinois, of course, still faces major issues, and we have yet to get transition reports from the various committees that Pritzker announced upon winning office, that he said at the time that we would get them about when he was inaugurated. And so 4 weeks in, we still don't really have any true answers to the meaty questions of how all of this is going to be paid for. It's really kind of going around and, in a sense, doing some things that are, some could say, courageous in the sense that he's getting pushback for, certainly. For example, the dealing with employee steps for AFSCME workers, that's something that not everybody's happy about. The courts ordered it. It probably needed to be done, or there was going to be more court action. It would have cost Illinois even more down the
right,
long
he's
run.
He's literally complying with the court order.
Amanda,
we have just about
pushback.
We just have about a minute left, so I want to ask you one last question that's not about Springfield at all, but it's actually about Chicago, because it's about political news in your area. And we haven't talked about the Chicago mayor's race on the show yet, but Election Day is February 26th. There's 14 candidates on the ballot. For people outside of Chicago, our listeners who have not been following this, how would you describe the campaign so far, as people maybe are paying to as we are looking at the last couple weeks of this Chicago mayor's race?
Unwieldy. I'm actually at Chicago City Hall as we speak, so apologies for any sort of echoes or elevators that you hear behind me. We're hearing from two of the candidates just this morning who are complaining that they're not invited to one televised debate, as you're seeing a lot of these forums having to be broken into two, or even at least our TV station is breaking them into three, because there are just so many candidates. And I will say that that's, I think, been a struggle for journalists to really, again, I will call ourselves out for trying to get to the meat of the issues. And I've spoken with a lot of voters who say they're just, you know, confused. So we will see. Certainly it has major consequences. And because that is such a wide open field, it is all but certain to go to a runoff. But the stakes are major at this point in time. And there are... The state has its significant financial issues, but the city of Chicago has its own schools. So there's a lot that this next mayor is going to be put in his or her lap.
That's Amanda Vinicky, correspondent with WTTW Chicago Tonight. Very busy, of course, covering not just Springfield, but the Chicago mayor's race. I want to thank Joe Bustos for being with us as well. He's a political reporter with the Belleville News Democrat. Guys, thanks for being with me.
Thanks.
Thanks for having us.
Speaking of politics, the 21st is going to Washington. All next week, we will be broadcasting from NPR headquarters, and we want to know what questions you have about our federal government, maybe about the shutdown or taxes. Let us know by going to askthe21st.org. Tomorrow, the story of the first African-American to get a PhD in chemistry. His name was St. Elmo Brady. He came to the U of I in 1912. All that and more coming up on tomorrow's program. You can always head to 21stshow.org. That's another good resource for you to find out more about the show. We are a production of Illinois Public Media, and I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. See you back here tomorrow.